In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
South Dakota's Attorney General says opioid settlement money should start flowing so people can get the help they need. From SDPB, today is Thursday, August 21st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Attorney General Marty Jackley says settlement money from many of the nation's top pharmaceutical companies should support treatment centers in Rapid City and Sioux Falls. We'll ask what happens next in South Dakota. Plus, a documentary explores the lives and losses of a U.S. Army unit in Vietnam. We'll talk about the men drafted into service and grafted into a brotherhood of sacrifice. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley, Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken, and Rapid City Mayor Jason Solomon announced plans Wednesday to use funds from the National Opioid Settlement to strengthen addiction treatment centers in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. Attorney General Marty Jackley joined me in the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls following the announcement. More than $50 billion across the country is going to be fed out to local states and local governments, and there is a wide range of how it is being spent, even though there are some restrictions on how it can be spent or some guidelines in the settlement. What's happening in South Dakota? Let's give people a little bit of background so they understand why we're getting this money, and then let's get into how you have decided and who gets to decide how it is going to be spent. Background first, please.
The background is this. I felt as Attorney General that there was an opioid and addiction crisis in the United States, and made a decision early on that when it came to the manufacturers and distributors of some of the opioids and other dangerous chemicals, that they have a debt to society, that they profited off some misinformation affecting public health and public safety. So early on as Attorney General, I began bringing lawsuits, some of them here in South Dakota and Pierre, others part of a national process. And ultimately, we've been able to, through this litigation and settlements, obtain a commitment of about $79 million. We've received about $31.5 million. I felt that Sioux Falls with Paul Tenhaken and Rapid City with Jason Solomon, the mayor, they are in the best position to fight addiction. They know their city programs. They know what's available. They know where the needs are. So I look at my role as Attorney General is to continue that litigation, keep these manufacturers and distributors from doing wrong, and also bring in as many dollars as we can to address the addiction and treatment issue that they have a responsibility of. And so I'm going to keep bringing those dollars in. They will increase. But today was the partnership. Mm-hmm. It was myself as Attorney General, the Sioux Falls and Rapid City Mayor saying, we have a plan. We recognize that addiction is a crisis today and can't wait till tomorrow. We have the funds available. We have a plan to put those funds to use. It makes perfect sense that it's Sioux Falls and Rapid for a couple of reasons. Number one, Sioux Falls is looking at having the men's prison. Rapid City has the women's prison. There become resource and additional needs when you have that in your town. We also know that other community areas rely upon available services in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. We see that with Brandon already putting some of the settlement proceeds back to Sioux Falls to take advantage of what Sioux Falls and Rapid City have and can do, recognize that there might be regional and satellite opportunities also with these dollars. But it was me saying my job as Attorney General is to bring these funds in, and I have the full reliance of the two mayors to put these dollars to use. The process is simple. There is a committee that the legislature formed when I wasn't Attorney General that took some of the authority away from the Attorney General and created a committee of 22. Our desire is to have a document go to that committee that says, this is our plan. I feel I have an important role in that because I was the attorney general that filed those lawsuits. I was attorney general that settled those lawsuits. I had actually asked for legislative support when I began doing this and wasn't able to receive that. So I think I have a say in it, but I also recognize I shouldn't be saying exactly where these dollars go. I don't know the community programs and needs as well as the mayors do, and I trust that they're going to be making the right decisions. In the event that the committee doesn't go this direction, I believe the need is there and the justification for me to go to the legislature and ask that that authority be given to the Attorney General to get these dollars to work now.
So the advisory committee, who has the money? Where's the money housed?
The
money
state,
that has not been spent yet. Yeah.
The state, through the advisory committee, it's a committee made up of 22. It's directly under the Department of Social Services.
Okay. So do they have the authority to spend it?
They do. Anytime, though, it always there's a level of what I would say appropriations and legislative oversight, but they have the authority through the grant process to distribute funds.
Okay.
So with the oversight of the legislature.
Okay. So you're saying this is where they should – this is my office's plan for how it should be done. Have you received support from that committee, or have they given you feedback on this plan?
I have begun conversations with the committee. Of course, one committee member is a member of the Attorney General's office. There were some committee members present at the press conference today. Okay. I've had good conversations with committee members. I've had conversations generally with the Department of Social Services, and I've also had those conversations with appropriators to get feedback, to make sure that there's a comfort level with this plan, and it has received overwhelming support. I think part of it goes back to our mayors. People respect that the mayors are looking out for their citizens. They have programs in place. They need this help, and these dollars should go to help them.
Yeah, because we want those dollars to go to evidence-based solutions to help the people who are actually impacted by the addiction.
That's exactly right. I mean, this isn't about law enforcement. This is about getting ahead of it with prevention and treatment, utilizing programs that are already in existence so that we don't reinvent the wheel. But there may be a new desire to create additional opportunities, but that rests with, in my opinion, the mayors that know their cities.
Yeah, and this money will be paid out over 18 years or so.
So $31.5 million is available now, okay, minus whatever the committee has spent, which will be a nominal amount. And then over time, it's scheduled to be $79 million, and there is additional litigation going for further opportunity for funds that I hope to finish up before I leave as Attorney General the next 16 months.
And as I understand it, 85% of that, according to the settlement, must be spent to address the epidemic.
That's exactly right. I mean, part of the concern I have is there has been an idea to put it in an endowment fund. Mm-hmm. I have two concerns with that. Legally, under the settlement documents, we would lose 15%. So I'm not prepared to give back to those companies 15% of $79 million. The other thing is, it's today's crisis. Why would we wait till tomorrow? That's more pain and suffering for families. That's more addiction, more challenges for our healthcare side of things, more challenging for law enforcement. Let's get to the root of the problem. Let's do it now. We have the ability to. Why are we waiting?
There's a sense of urgency.
Yes.
And for the families who have been impacted, my research was showing this morning, there's very little money that went directly to the people who were impacted. Most of the settlements went to governments, and some of the people who are impacted are saying, you need to spend that money, and you need to spend it to help families because we're still suffering. This isn't a problem from the 1990s. We can look back at advertising from the 1990s and see where the seeds were planted. This is a problem people are living out today.
Yes. And again, I feel that's the justification to say, look, we have a plan. It's time to put these dollars to use and protect our families and citizens. I mean, that's what these dollars are for.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say on this? What happens next with it, or what we should be watching for in the future as far as accountability in the mayor's office, for example, what kind of reporting they would have, that kind of thing? What's the future look like?
So what the future looks like is a proposal coming from the mayors and the attorney general to the committee, respect for the process. I hope that the committee makes that proposal stronger and better, and then ultimately possibly going to the legislature. There's already accountability put in place, both with the language of the settlement agreements, with the AG's office, so that accountability is already there. And the reality is the citizens of Sioux Falls, the citizens of Rapid City have said, these are our mayors. the electorate's the best accountability. And they said, these are the individuals we want making these type decisions. And again, they are in a much better position than I am as Attorney General to know and understand how their existing treatment programs and prevention efforts can be helped with these dollars.
All right. Attorney General Marty Jackley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Attorney General Marty Jackley. After the break, we hear from a filmmaker and a Vietnam veteran. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB airs the documentary Man Chu, A Brotherhood of Sacrifice on Friday, August 22nd at 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain on SDPB TV. It's the story of the U.S. Army's 4th Battalion, 9th Infantry Regiment, 25th Infantry Division in Vietnam between 1966 and 1970. The Manchus carry that nickname because of action in Manchuria during the 1900s. Their unit motto is Keep Up the Fire. To prepare for the documentary, we're going to connect today with the film's director, Matt Wilcox. Also joining us, Vietnam veteran Stanley Adams. Adams wrote a memoir documenting his time in Vietnam. It's called Mo Cain to Mole City. It covers his time in country, 1968 to 1969. A note to listeners, this conversation contains descriptions of combat, PTSD, and trauma. I want to start with you, Matt Wilcox, the director of this documentary, because you first heard the story in high school. A fascinating beginning. Before you even knew who Stan Adams was, you had a shop teacher who had been to Vietnam. Tell me a little bit about being a young student interested in history and hearing a story at the front of the classroom.
Well, it was one of those things that the teacher didn't really want to talk too much about it, but I was into video in high school, video production, and I wanted to start diving into different stories that happened, history stories, veteran stories, war stories. And the veteran's name is Steve Knowlton. He was a shop teacher at my high school, and I asked him what his experiences were. We sat down one morning. He told me everything he went through. I was 17 at the time. And I kept this information, if you will, kind of in a folder and wanted to see what we could do with it someday. And I had a lot to learn on my own side of it with production, story writing, being able to create an actual documentary that many, many moons later, after graduation and not until 2020, did I really say that we should pull together the, an actual film and go forward with it. The problem with Mr. Knowlton's story is that it was one perspective and it was one tale that he remembered. And this is, 45, 50 years plus now during that time period. So I needed to have some sort of backup or, more to the story so we could research. And that's when Facebook came in handy and I was able to find Mr. and Mrs. Adams. And they found out about the wonderful novel that was written, the memoir and that history and how much work that both the Adams have done to bring together veterans, but also the stories that they were able to find and connections that they were able to make. So yeah, it had a long lineage, but it was really just one of those things that I kept in the back pocket until it was able to be made. So.
And we all know what was happening in the world in 2020. What was happening in your life in 2020? Was it that you had more time on your hands, or was there something else that gave this a sense of urgency where you would tell this story?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the 2020, obviously the pandemic, we're kind of, shelter in place, if you will, across the country. Not that things were getting terrible when I first started, we were looking at March into April, and we knew that as the news was releasing that COVID was hitting different hotspots in the country, I kind of did something a little bit more daring. And I said, well, we have the time. Let's go find these people and see if I can travel the country. So I did that. And of course, we had to keep that in the background that anywhere I went, some people from Florida may not be welcome into some other states because it was a little bit more of an outbreak in Florida at that time, at those days and months of that of the beginning of the pandemic. So, yeah, it was an opportunity, I suppose, but it was also the idea that Vietnam is getting longer, you know, further and further away in time. So the veterans are getting older, and we need to get these stories saved now. And you'll see that in the documentary too, is that a few of our veterans that we did interview have passed on, unfortunately, but yeah. Thank goodness we did get them when we did.
Stan Adams, I want to bring you into the conversation now. I'm sure you're aware you're getting older and fortunate to be getting older. The book, Mokane to Mole City, which is in Missouri where you grew up.
Right.
Your wife, Rita, of course, was instrumental in helping you track people down. It's an exhaustive look from a photography standpoint. The number of images and details you were able to put in the book. Tell us about the book and some of the work that you and Rita did to put it together. Why was that important to you at the time?
Well, I felt like I needed to mention some of the people I served with because I, you know, they're forgotten right now by everybody. But it was an experience that I wouldn't want anybody to have to go through. But the book was part of something that I felt like I had to do. My captain, I met him at a reunion, and he's the one that said, maybe we ought to, you know, start writing something up about our unit. If not, it's going to be lost. So he kept looking at me, and so I guess he picked me out for it. I'm going, well, ain't no way in heck I can write a book. You know, I was lucky to get out of high school, more or less anything else. And yeah, I started going to the VA hospital, talked to a counselor in 2005, I think it was. And at the VA hospital in Columbia, Missouri, they deal with PTSD is they want you to write down your nightmares or your experiences, put them together later on, you know, and that way you'll have them. Well, from 2005 to 2019, I think it was, boy, I had a huge stack of stuff that I had written about, and in the middle of the night I'd wake up, I'd go over and write a little bit. But from that it went from that to one day my psychiatrist said, well, you know, you got enough ear for a book, and I really think it would help you if you do this. And I'm going, well, I don't know about that. But anyway, it was something I said, well, I'll try to. So the next time I saw Captain Cabral, I said, all right, I'm going to do this. But it took me a long time to get all the info that I wanted. My daughter, Kim, she's an attorney. I wrote so much of it in military lingo, you know how that is, that she was telling me, Dad, they're not going to understand this. So, okay. She said, well, I'll help you write it. So she took over the wording for it, which she's a real good writer, which really helped me out quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So I was very happy that she got involved with it because she always asked me about it and I never really could talk about it. So.
Yeah. Matt, I think that's a strength of the film in that you allow the veterans to tell their stories using the language that makes sense to them. But before we get to the language, you've explained to us what it's going to be in a very unobtrusive, sort of seamless and natural way. So first of all, I noticed that. And I'm wondering how you approach that idea of not stopping their storytelling, especially when they're on the camera, by saying, oh, what does that mean? What does that mean? But then also making sure that civilians would know what in the world an Eagle flight is, what in the world, you know, a hot LZ is, you know, things that they might not know. What was that that process like for you, Matt?
One of the things that's funny about interviewing and video is that you always want to get the true story from the person, right? Whenever you do a documentary, you don't want to obviously inhibit them from telling what they know. I think that the veteran, especially in a war documentary, the veteran's the expert. They were the ones there. They are the ones who need to express what happened to them. And they're going to do it in the way that they know and the terminology that they understand from the time and even now. We need to provide as a storytelling technique for those who don't understand that to be followed up or precursed with it so they know what's happening and understand it. In a deeper sense of it, though, having a veteran talk about their experience is more than just a documentary interview. It's almost a therapy session, because you're trying to let this person go into a very traumatic moment in their life. And you're pushing, in some cases gently, but you're pushing to get those memories out so we can have them on camera, so we can maintain that history. But you're doing it carefully, because these, on quite a few occasions, you know, it can bring up kind of a flashback, or it can bring up a resurgence of that memory. And that's something that is difficult, but in most cases, veterans would say that they're very appreciative to get that story out, because they've been keeping it inside for decades. Yeah. And they don't really, one of the terrible things about any traumatic experience is that sometimes people, many times people wish to keep it inside, but after many decades, you kind of want to tell somebody what happened. And there's not always somebody to listen. So that's the kind of the technique I take from a filmmaker's perspective. Let the person talk. Listen.
Stan, one of the things that struck me about your story was in the very beginning, where you say in the film that when you went over, you didn't know what to expect. You thought you'd just be dropped off into the war. And instead, there was a processing. There was a, you know, here's the unit you're going to be assigned to. And it's a reminder of, you know, as someone who's been in the military myself and a daughter of a Vietnam veteran, that was one thing my dad always taught me. He was like, you're not going to have any idea where you're going until you're already there.
Yeah.
Which really turned out to be true. But I think a lot of civilians don't know that, the uncertainty that you faced. Tell us about going to Vietnam for the first time, getting off the aircraft and saying, here I am, and it's not what I thought.
Yeah. First of all, I want to mention Daryl Cavan. I met him in basic training. We went to AIT, went to Vietnam together. So me and him were sitting on the plane. We were landing, and at that time, the co-pilot or pilot said, they're getting mortars on the runway and small arms fire. You have to get off the plane as fast as you can and go to the tarmac, or, you know. So we're going, well, this is a hell of a way to come into this, you know. But we got off the plane. I couldn't believe how hot it was and how bad it stunk. I don't know from what, but whatever. But I just remember running, and there was a tractor in front of us that had, I think, five different trailers, and they had bodies on them. And it was not just a few. I mean, the trailers were full. And they were going to put them underneath the plane where the refrigeration units are. And that's what they were going to do with them. But the experience of getting off that plane and going in the tarmac there, and it was nothing that I had ever experienced in my life. And I knew from there that this is going to be one heck of a year, you know. And anybody that spent a year in that, it's hard to talk about, because you lose people that you're close to, and it bothers you to say anything about them, because you know you're going to get very emotional with it. Once I got off that plane and we got on the bus, of course they had the wire mesh over the, you know, window, so they couldn't throw anything in on you. We went to I think it was MACV, Military Airlift Command. And from there, they assigned us to a division. We went to the 25th Division, and we flew from in Saigon to Cu Chi, where the 25th Division headquarters was. From there, they assigned us to the Manchus. Well, from there, they flew us by a cargo plane. I'm trying to remember the name, but anyway, we flew from there to Tainan, which was a small village, but boy, it was real close to Cambodia. And they call it a Rocket Alley around there. So, you know, it seemed like almost every night somebody was getting mortar somewhere. You could lay there in your bunker in the middle of the night looking, you could see it all happening. So, and then from there, we went to the Manchus. When we were in Cu Chi processing, we were all getting on the plane to go, you know, go to the Tainan area. We had a bunch of guys that were processing out. Mm-hmm. And of course, I hate to say this, but they were saying, you're dead already, MF, you know. So it was like, it was a wake-up call there. We're like, oh, man, you know, what is this? Because we told them we were going to the Manchus, and they go, oh, no, you're in stuff all the time. Well, we were.
Yeah.
So it was different. It you know, different than everything I ever had in my life. So.
Yeah. And Matt, this brings up what Stan is saying. Another way that I think this documentary is of service is that people like Stan don't always know what the big picture was. They have a very ground view, but you might not understand the full scope of the history of the Manchus, for example. How many battles had just happened before Stan arrived to really replace some of those soldiers who were killed in previous battles? As you put together the full story, Matt, especially, and I want to make sure we talk about this 8mm footage, because that's a really quite extraordinary contribution. You're also putting together a battle history that the people in the documentary might not even know.
Yes. It's difficult because the Vietnam War was different than most conflicts up until that point in American history, where you could be flown into a hot battle zone, essentially as Mr. Adams had, landing into one. And then you were just thrown into a mix of a platoon, of a squad, of a unit. And then a few guys might have their time in country end, and they'd be sent home. And maybe right in the middle of a firefight, they'd be said, hey, get on the chopper, you're going home. So having that whole experience is kind of individual. It's a very individual perspective on each person because they had a different experience than people who showed up in 1966 or those who were there in 1970. So understanding how to mesh those stories together and make some sort of cohesive sense of it is part of the problem of understanding Vietnam as a conflict in American history, but also understanding it from a veteran's perspective. If you can throw somebody into the film and just say, you're in this now, you know, and you try to make sense of where you came from or where some soldiers were or some battles that happened, and then realizing that each veteran that joins the unit winds up usually being a replacement to somebody who either was shifting home or was wounded or killed in action. And that understanding is very difficult. It's a very, very psychologically difficult thing to process. But also having all the other aspects of what were happening in the mid to late 60s, and having film, having cameras that soldiers could carry, you know, a motion camera in their pocket was amazing. And one of the things that was different between the North, where the Marines were, and really the Central and the South, where the Army was, is that a lot of the draftees were able to bring cameras. And including my school teacher, Steve Knowlton, and many, many other guys, they had 8mm film, Super 8, and they would take out a camera, and in the middle of getting shot at, in some cases, not always, kind of busy when you're getting shot at, they would start filming the event. So when you watch this film, you do see some stock footage that we have that was used in archival purposes to make sense of the storyline. But a lot of it, you're watching these guys, you're seeing them at 19, 20, 22 years old, and you're watching their footage. That's what makes it a very unique film in that sense, too. You're not seeing something that was entirely just from a cameraman from a news station. You're watching footage that was taken by them. So you get a very personal perspective. And what's so great about it in storytelling and documentary work is that we have footage. We have archival documents that indicate battles. We have the photos that were taken. So when a veteran talks about, oh, yeah, I remember being in Cu Chi, well, we have a lot of those primary documents that we can use to allow the audience to have a better picture of what was happening.
Yeah. And Stan, when you get together with other people who took photos, you add your photos to them.
Yes.
That becomes a powerful thing as well to look back on. Mm-hmm. And how young you are in the pictures.
Well, 20.
It's just astonishing to see how many just really, because the Selective Service was 18 to what, 55, but those are 19 and 20-year-olds who are there. Yeah.
Oldest guy we had was 24. So.
Yeah.
He was our captain, so, and he'd already been over there once. So, but yeah, it was just quite a different place, you know.
What I'm wondering in this moment is if you did you realize when you were taking pictures and when other people were taking pictures that there would be a purpose to them in the future?
Yeah, I had a little bitty Minolta camera. It took slides, and I had a hard time getting slides there, so I would send it all to my mom, and then they would develop the pictures. But every reunion we have, a new guy comes in or somebody old said, oh, look at this. Well, they showing pictures of everybody. And sometimes you'll go, oh, these two or three of me and that I've never even seen before. So that's where a lot of the pictures came from, was, you know, from people that we served with, basically. We also had a AP reporter, I think a guy named was Sears. And when we go back to the rear area for anything, there was a big table there, and he produced a lot of pictures and put them on the table, and you could take any one you wanted. So it was, you know, we had access to a lot of pictures, you know, but, and some of them were bad. So, you know, we tried to get rid of those. That's why I did put a few in my book, but I didn't want to go into a lot of detail with that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. More with Stan Adams and Matt Wilcox after the break. The documentary Manchu, A Brotherhood of Sacrifice, airs Friday, August 22nd at 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain on SDPB-TV. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB airs the documentary Manchu, A Brotherhood of Sacrifice, on Friday, August 22nd at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain, on SDPB-TV. We're talking today with the film's director, Matt Wilcox. Also joining us is Vietnam veteran Stanley Adams. Adams is featured in the film. He also wrote a memoir documenting his time in Vietnam. It is called Mocaine to Mole City. When we talked with Adams, he was not alone. He was joined around a kitchen table with his wife, Rita, and another veteran featured in the film. You'll hear from Dave Hosenfeld later in this hour. A note to listeners, the conversation you're about to hear contains descriptions of combat, injury, and trauma. You've said so much in the book and in the film that I don't want to make you relive anything today, but some of the Mole City, how it is built and the battle there, I would like to talk about in a way that doesn't upset anyone. So Matt, tell me a little bit about the importance of this encampment, because there isn't a front in Vietnam. There isn't, we're taking this land, you know, we're taking hills. There's a lot of taking hills, losing higher ground, taking higher ground. At some point, the main purpose from the United States government is body count and nothing else. So it's a difficult strategic plan to understand sometimes for civilians. What is the point of this underground city? Matt, let's start with you, and then we'll ask Stan for his thoughts on that. Yeah.
I don't know if Matt will know too much about that, but all right, go ahead, Matt.
No, well, I mean, definitely, you know, the guys that were there are definitely the experts on it. But one of the things that we tried to allude, of course, and understand in the documentary is that when you look at Mole City, for instance, it was that in that specific area of Vietnam, the Tay Ninh province area, it was a large inlet of what we called the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So the North Vietnamese supplies were coming down from North Vietnam, going through Laos, going into Cambodia, and then coming through into Tay Ninh province specifically, because it was northwest of Saigon, and it was a good inlet for there. Now, if you look at a map and you can actually look at where Tay Ninh, the city, and Tay Ninh province are located, you can see that it's what they call the parrot's beak. And the land design is kind of interwoven between Cambodia and Vietnam. So American forces could defend, according to our strategic initiatives in Vietnam, they could defend South Vietnam, but they could not enter into Cambodia. So at the end of 1968, which was a pivotal point in the entire war, the powers to be said, let's put a base on the border, not far from Cambodia, where essentially they could entice enemy forces to attack. So dare I say, they were basically bait. The American forces were basically bait to lure out enemy forces and to kill them. And it worked. It worked to that level. However, this was the strategy, this was the strategic thinking of higher command in the military, was let's sacrifice a few of Americans' lives so we can eradicate more of theirs and have a body count ratio. Now, I do want to obviously go to Mr. Adams and anybody who experienced that, because that is, again, that is just a horrific understanding of what your job is. Mm-hmm. What you're sent to Vietnam to do is to be on the front lines of something that somebody decided, we're going to use you guys to entice the enemy. Yeah. I want to turn it over to Mr. Adams.
Yeah. Stan, tell us about Mole City.
I got in Vietnam in November of 28th in 1968. They flew us out on helicopters to a base camp called Austin. We were there, I think, about 3 weeks, and word came down from Lieutenant Colonel Wilson that we were going to build a base camp and disrupt the supplies coming from Cambodia into Vietnam. And so where we were at, most of us were all around in the rice fields. So, you know, sometimes it rained, it'd be tremendous rain, and then other times it's dry for 6 months. But anyway, they came around and told us that, you know, we're going to have to build a base camp that's going to have to withstand battle that's going to be fought, because we had scout planes, and they were picking up, I think it was a regiment, the 9th Regiment from the North Vietnam in Cambodia, and they were seeing them, and they were kind of gearing up for something. And when we built that base camp, that's who hit us. They already knew that what the unit was that he was even going to hit us. But anyway, we said, well, you know, what could we do, build to that would actually, you know, help us out in the long run? Well, they wanted us to put all of our bunkers underground, you know, I'm talking about deep underground, 4 feet or something. And then we put PSP, you know, the steel above it. We'd put like 6 stacks of, you know, sandbags on it. But our firing ports were maybe a foot, you know, maybe 12 inches or something. So if you were outside the base camp and you looked in, the only thing you could see was our tower. We were basically all underground. We dug trenches to all the bunkers so you could move inside the base camp without being seen or, you know, or hit with enemy fire or something. I really believe if it hadn't been for that, oh man, I don't know what would have happened that night. We built a base camp on a road, which we kind of was leery about that, because there was a lot of trees and vegetation on the road. And we were all worried about that. If we were going to get hit, that's where they would come through, because you wouldn't be able to see them. You might pick it up on radar, but you wouldn't be able to see them. And that's where they hit us at. It was over there in Charlie Company and part of Bravo Company. But the basic idea was to get everybody underground and try to, you know, entice the enemy over there and take care of as much as they could. So, and they did. They took care of a lot of them. So
December 22nd, 2,400 enemy combatants against
2 companies that were short on people anyway. So we maybe 100 in each company. We had, and some of them were cooks. We had like S2 out there. You know, we had mortar. They brought out a 105 mortar, or not mortar, but cannon. And they used that night, you know, firing directly into the enemy coming into the base camp. So.
Yeah. Cooks, supply clerks, mail clerks, everybody.
Well, we had one of the cooks, he come down to the bunker line, got killed at that battle. So we always, you know, everybody was over there, you know, here it was, no matter who it was, pick up a gun and help, you know, type of thing. So,
yeah. These are the kinds of things that stay with you for an entire lifetime.
Yes. I'll never forget it.
What do you want people to remember about the Manchus as their legacy?
Yeah, I really believe that all the conflicts that we were in along Cambodian border, if there was another unit that had got into more conflicts than us, I don't know who it would be. It seemed like every day or every other day we were getting shot at or something, or we going on an Eagle flight, and, you know, and they're tearing the plane up with, you know, small arms fire or the chopper. And so it's a legacy that I think that, you know, ought to be told is, well, we had a lot of guys killed and a lot of guys were very brave. And I can say that about them. And we had a lot of guys killed. So
you have we're reaching you around a kitchen table, and you've got a friend with you there, Dave Hosenfeld.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who's also featured in the documentary. Would he like to join our conversation here at the end for a minute? Hello, welcome, Dave.
Well, thank you.
I'm wondering, as you sit and listen to Stan and to Matt tell this story, if there's something that you wanted to add about the legacy of the men who fought with the Manchus and the ones who survived.
Yeah. Well, the worst fight we was in was before Stan got there, about a month before.
Yeah, we were replacements.
Yeah, we went in the hot LZ, landed. First, we went on an Eagle flight, and we didn't have no contact, so they sent us somewhere else, and it was terribly bad. I think we had, there was 10 choppers went in. They said we had 18 killed and 30-some of us wounded, so they about.
Mm-hmm. That was when you first got off the chopper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then... my best friend, there's five of us on this chopper, and my best friend, he got shot up real bad, and then I got hit, and then the two guys that got out on the other side, both of them got killed, they friends of mine, and the other one, I don't know what happened to him. He went to get help, and he never came back. I don't know if he got killed or, but it's a terrible thing to see all that.
What do you think the value of a book and a documentary are for people to learn about this time?
Well, I think they should realize how brave we really were. Dumb, I don't know, you know, but yeah, it's just a terrible war. It's,
yeah.
You see your best friends get killed, and you got to live with that. It's hard to do. It's real hard. So.
Yeah. Matt, as we reach the end of our time here together, I'm wondering, as you sat with all these people and heard their stories, how you were changed as a filmmaker, as an American.
My background's history. I've studied a lot of conflicts and things like that. Understanding wars and all that. Vietnam wasn't something that necessarily has become an academic study. And I wanted to kind of dive into it. So talking with these guys and understanding what they went through, one of the terrible things is that each one had a story that would left an impression on me. And I mean, you can hear some of those in the documentary, but they lived through this for 365 plus or minus a few days, where they literally put their life on the line every single day, or saw someone who did, and in many cases they didn't come home alive anyhow. It's difficult as a filmmaker, as a historian, but really as an American to watch to hear about your countrymen, about the guys that were young kids that were forced to go and endure incredible sacrifice. I mean, incredible bravery, and to help each other on the front line, and not feel the absolute sadness of it, the absolute emotional connection that they would have with each other, and also with what they were doing it for. They did it for their country, but they did it for each other.
Right.
And when they came home, to be treated the way they were, and I'm not just talking about protesters at an airport. I'm talking about the way the government wanted to kind of keep it quiet, not to give benefits, not to help out with the VA. Things are much better today. I want to make that clear. And I say that only based on what they say, but you have to, that's a whole social context going on in the Vietnam era. But to understand that these men went through way more days on average of combat than most World War II veterans did. And we should never compare any conflict. We should never you, if you spend 2 seconds in combat, you have earned yourself that title of understanding what that reality is. But to understand that these guys went through it on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, the fear of knowing that there could be somebody behind a bush or in a rice paddy, or knowing that you're being watched, and they were watched by everybody. So we owe, as a collective, as a country, we owe a huge thank you for what they did. And we also owe a huge apology, you know. We should never take our assets and spend them that way. So
it is a powerful documentary. It is a powerful book. And it has been an honor for me to sit in conversation with all of you. So Matt Wilcox, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Mr. Stan Adams and Dave Hostenfeld.
Yes.
I appreciate your time and sharing a small part of your story. I hope that this part was all right for you, too. I know you've already told the story so much, but I appreciate you showing up for public radio to answer questions in person, too. It's a big deal to me.
We had 428 Manchus killed while we were there. And we had a kid from Millsville, South Dakota, and his name was Carlos Yellow Elk. And he was killed August the 29th, 1968. And talked to a guy named Doug Farrell that was out on the operation with him. Said he was a very brave kid. So just to give a little kudos to him, he's buried in the Black Hills National Cemetery. And my best friend that got killed is from Hanover, North Dakota, a guy named Gilbert Bargman. And that if there's one thing that's bothered me the whole time that I've with my Vietnam experience was that kid, because it felt like he got shot and we tried to get up to him and we couldn't get up there, and you get a guilt feeling like if you would have got up there, maybe you could have saved him, but it doesn't work out that way. So anyway, I wanted to throw that in there because I think the people from North Dakota will probably watch the movie.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I want to say something about them.
Yeah. So. Thank you for saying your names.
Yeah, he was a great kid. We called him Gil, but Gil Favor, you know, Rawhide, because he loved horses. So, you know, he talked about horses all the time. So anyway, I wanted to throw that in there. I do give kudos to the Manchus because we had 428 guys KIA, but I'll bet we had 10,000 wounded. Every battle we had, there was three times as many wounded as there was killed. So, and how many died afterwards, I don't know. So I wanted to throw that in there.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, thank you. It's like I said, an honor to tell the stories and to keep some of those names said on the air. Again and again, we'll continue to do that work as long as we can. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori.
The documentary Manchu, A Brotherhood of Sacrifice airs Friday, August 22nd at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. That's on SDPB TV. Stanley Adams has also written a book. It's called Mokane to Mole City, A Manchu Vietnam Memoir. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by R. Youngeman and Ellen Kester. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.